Disc 3.
She might even have a job at McDonald's and she leaves the kids with her sister. You never know. But they don't stay in one place. I seriously doubted if Ontario's mother had a job, but I wasn't about to debate this with Miss Dolly in her kitchen. Mordecai arrived as the line was forming for lunch. I saw him before he saw me, and when our eyes made contact, his entire face smiled. A new volunteer had sandwich duty. Mordecai and I worked the serving tables, dipping ladles into the pots and pouring the soup into the plastic bowls. There was an art to it. Too much broth, and the recipient might glare at you. Too many vegetables, and there would be nothing left but broth. Mordecai had perfected his technique years ago. I suffered a number of glaring looks before I caught on. Mordecai had a pleasant word for everyone we served. Hello, good morning, how are you, nice to see you again. Some of them smiled back, others never looked up. As noon approached, the doors grew busier and the lines longer. More volunteers appeared from nowhere, and the kitchen hummed with the pleasant clutter and bang of happy people busy with their work. I kept looking for Ontario. Santa Claus was waiting, and the little fella didn't have a clue. We waited until the lines were gone, then filled a bowl each. The tables were packed, so we ate in the kitchen, leaning against the sink. "You remember that diaper you changed last night?" I asked between bites.
"As if I could forget."
"I haven't seen them today." He chewed and thought about it for a second.
"They were here when I left this morning."
"What time was that?"
6. "They were in the corner over there, sound asleep."
"Where would they go?"
"You never know.
The little boy told me they stayed in a car."
"You talked to him?"
"Yeah."
"And now you want to find him, don't you?"
"Yeah."
"Don't count on it."
After lunch, the sun popped through and the movement began. One by one, they walked by the serving table, took an apple or an orange, and left the basement. "The homeless are also restless," Mordecai explained as we watched. "They like to roam around. They have rituals and routines, favorite places, friends on the streets, things to do. They'll go back to their parks and alleys and dig out from the snow."
"It's 20 degrees outside, near zero tonight," I said.
"They'll be back. Wait till dark and this place will be hopping again. Let's take a ride."
We checked in with Miss Dolly, who excused us for a while. Mordecai's well-used Ford Taurus was parked next to my Lexus.
"That won't last long around here," he said, pointing at my car. "If you plan to spend time in this part of town, I'd suggest you trade down."
I hadn't dreamed of parting with my fabulous car. I was almost offended. We got into his Taurus and slid out of the parking lot. Within seconds, I realized Mordecai Green was a horrible driver, and I attempted to fasten my seatbelt. It was broken. He seemed not to notice. We drove the well-plowed streets of Northwest Washington. Blocks and sections of boarded-up row houses, past projects so tough ambulance drivers refused to enter, past schools with razor wire glistening on top of the chain link, into neighborhoods permanently scarred by riots. He was an amazing tour guide. Every inch was his turf. Every corner had a story. Every street had a history. We passed other shelters and kitchens. He knew the cooks and the reverends. Churches were good or bad, with no blurring of the lines. They either opened their doors to the homeless or kept them locked. He pointed out the law school at Howard, a place of immense pride for him. His legal education had taken 5 years at night while he worked a full-time job and a part-time one. He showed me a burned-out row house where crack dealers once operated. His third son, Cassius, had died on the sidewalk in front of it. When we were near his office, he asked if it would be all right to stop in for a minute. He wanted to check his mail. I certainly didn't mind. I was just along for the ride. It was dim, cold, and empty. He flipped on light switches and began talking.
"There are three of us. Me, Sophia Mendoza, and Abraham LeBeau. Sophia's a social worker, but she knows more street law than me and Abraham combined."
I followed him around the cluttered desks.
Used to have 7 lawyers crammed in here, can you believe it? That was when we got federal money for legal services. Now we don't get a dime, thanks to the Republicans. There are 3 offices over there, 3 here on my side. He was pointing in all directions. Lots of empty space. Maybe empty from a lack of personnel, but it was hard to walk without tripping over a basket of old files or a stack of dusty law books.
Who owns the building? I asked.
The Cohen Trust. Leonard Cohen was the founder of a big New York law firm. He died in 86, must have been 100 years old. He made a ton of money, and late in life he decided he didn't want to die with any of it, so he spread it around. And one of his many creations was a trust to help poverty lawyers assist the homeless. That's how this place came to be. The trust operates 3 clinics, here, New York, and Newark. I was hired in 83, became the director in 84.
All your funding comes from one source?
Practically all. Last year the trust gave us $110,000. Year before it was $150,000, so we lost a lawyer. It gets smaller every year. The trust has not been well managed, and it's now eating the principal. I doubt if we'll be here in 5 years, maybe 3.
Can't you raise money?
Oh, sure. Last year we raised $9,000. But it takes time. We can practice law, or we can raise funds. Sophia is not good with people. Abraham is an abrasive ass from New York. That leaves just me and my magnetic personality.
What's the overhead? I asked, prying, but not too worried. Almost every nonprofit group published an annual report with all the figures.
$2,000 a month. After expenses and a small reserve, the 3 of us split $89,000. Equally, Sophia considers herself a full partner. Frankly, we're afraid to argue with her. I took home almost 30, which, from what I hear, is about average for a poverty lawyer. Welcome to the street.
We finally made it to his office, and I sat across from him. Did you forget to pay your heating bill? I asked, almost shivering.
Probably. We don't work much on weekends. Saves money. This place is impossible to heat or cool.
That thought had never occurred to anyone at Drake and Sweeney. Close on weekends, save money. And marriages.
And if we keep it too comfortable, our clients won't leave. So it's cold in the winter, hot in the summer, cuts down on the street traffic. You want coffee?
No, thanks.
I'm joking, you know. We wouldn't do anything to discourage the homeless from being here. The climate doesn't bother us. We figure our clients are cold and hungry, so why should we worry about those matters?
Did you feel guilty when you ate breakfast this morning?
Yes. He gave me the smile of a wise old man who'd seen it all. That's very common. We used to work with a lot of young lawyers from the big firms, pro bono rookies, I call them, and they would tell me all the time that they lost interest in food at first. He patted his ample midsection. But you'll get over it.
What did the pro bono rookies do? I asked. I knew I was moving toward the bait, and Mordecai knew I knew.
We sent them into the shelters. They met the clients, and we supervised the cases for them. Most of the work is easy. It just takes a lawyer on the phone barking at some bureaucrat who won't move. Food stamps, veterans' pensions, housing subsidies, Medicaid, aid to children. About 25% of our work deals with benefits.
I listened intently, and he could read my mind. Mordecai began to reel me in.
You see, Michael, the homeless have no voice. No one listens. No one cares. And they expect no one to help them. So when they try to use the phone to get benefits due them, they get nowhere. They're put on hold permanently. Their calls are never returned. They have no addresses. The bureaucrats don't care, and so they screw the very people they're supposed to help. A seasoned social worker can at least get the bureaucrats to listen, and maybe look at the file and maybe return a phone call. But you get a lawyer on the phone, barking and raising hell, and things happen. Bureaucrats get motivated, papers get processed. No address, no problem. Send the check to me. I'll get it to the client.
His voice was rising, both hands waving through the air. On top of everything else, Mordecai was the consummate storyteller. I suspected he was very effective in front of a jury.
A funny story, he said. About a month ago, one of my clients went down to the Social Security office to pick up an application for benefits. Should have been a routine matter. He's 60 years old and in constant pain from a crooked back. Sleep on rocks and park benches for 10 years, you got back problems. He waited in line outside the office for 2 hours, finally got in the door, waited another hour, made it up to the first desk, tried to explain what he wanted, and proceeded to get a tongue-lashing from a hard-ass secretary who was having a bad day. She even commented on his odor. He was humiliated, of course, and left without his paperwork. He called me. I made my calls, and last Wednesday we had a little ceremony down at the Social Security office. I was there along with my client. The secretary was there along with her supervisor's supervisor, the D.C. office director, and a big man from the Social Security Administration. The secretary stood in front of my client and read a one-page apology. It was real nice, touching. She then handed me his application for benefits, and I got assurances from everybody present that it would receive immediate attention. That's justice, Michael. That's what street law is all about. Dignity. The stories rolled on, one after the other, all ending with the street lawyers as the good guys, the homeless as the victors. I knew he had tucked away in his repertoire just as many heartbreaking tales, probably more, but he was laying the groundwork. I lost track of time. He never mentioned his mail. We finally left and drove back to the shelter. It was an hour before dark. A good time, I thought, to get tucked away in the cozy little basement before the hoodlums began roaming the streets. I caught myself walking slow and confident when Mordecai was at my side. Otherwise, I would have been slashing through the snow, bent at the waist, my nervous feet barely touching the ground. Miss Dolly had somehow procured a pile of whole chickens, and she was laying for me. She boiled the birds, I picked their steaming flesh. Mordecai's wife, Joanne, joined us for the rush hour. She was as pleasant as her husband, and almost as tall. Both sons were 6'6". Cassius had been 6'9", a heavily recruited basketball star when he was shot at the age of 17. I left at midnight. No sign of Ontario and his family. Chapter 10. Sunday began with a late morning call from Claire, another stilted chat she initiated, only to tell me what time she would be home. I suggested we have dinner at our favorite restaurant, but she was not in the mood. I didn't ask her if anything was wrong. We were beyond that. Since our apartment was on the third floor, I had been unable to make satisfactory arrangements to have the Sunday Post home delivered. We had tried various methods, but I never found the paper half the time. I showered and dressed in layers. The weatherman predicted a high of 25, and as I was getting ready to leave the apartment, the news person rattled off the morning's top story. It stopped me cold. I heard the words, but they didn't register immediately. I walked closer to the TV on the kitchen counter, my feet heavy, my heart frozen, my mouth open in shock and disbelief. Sometime around 11 p.m., D.C. police found a small car near Fort Totten Park in the northeast, in a war zone. It was parked on the street, its bald tires stuck in the frozen slush. Inside were a young mother and her four children, all dead from asphyxiation. The police suspected the family lived in the car and was trying to stay warm. The automobile's tailpipe was buried in a pile of snow plowed from the street. A few details, but no names. I raced to the sidewalk, sliding in the snow but staying on my feet, then down P Street to Wisconsin, over to 34th to a newsstand. Out of breath and horrified, I grabbed a paper. On the bottom corner of the front page was the story, obviously thrown in at the last minute. No names. I yanked open Section A, dropping the rest of the paper onto the wet sidewalk. The story continued on page 14 with a few standard comments from the police and the predictable warnings about the dangers of clogged tailpipes. Then the heartbreaking details. The mother was 22. Her name was Lante Burton,
The baby was Tomiko. The younger toddlers were Alonzo and Dante, age 2. The big brother was Ontario, age 4. I must have made a strange sound, because a jogger gave me an odd look as if I might be dangerous. I began walking away, holding the paper open, stepping on the other 20 sections.
"Excuse me," a nasty voice called from behind. "Would you like to pay for that?"
I kept walking. He approached from the rear and yelled, "Hey, pal!" I stopped long enough to pull a $5 bill from my pocket and throw it at his feet, hardly looking at him. On P, near the apartment, I leaned on a brick retaining wall in front of someone's splendid row house. The sidewalk had been meticulously shoveled. I read the story again, slowly, hoping that somehow the ending would be different. Thoughts and questions came in torrents, and I couldn't keep up with them. But two repeated themselves. Why didn't they return to the shelter? And did the baby die wrapped in my denim jacket? Thinking was burden enough. Walking was almost impossible. After the shock, the guilt hit hard. Why didn't I do something Friday night when I first saw them? I could have taken them to a warm motel and fed them. The phone was ringing when I entered my apartment. It was Mordecai. He asked if I'd seen the story. I asked if he remembered the wet diaper. "Same family," I said. He'd never heard their names. I told him more about my encounter with Ontario. "I'm very sorry, Michael," he said, much sadder now. "So am I." I couldn't say much. The words wouldn't form. So we agreed to meet later. I went to the sofa, where I remained for an hour without moving. Then I went to my car and removed the bags of food and toys and clothing I'd bought for them. Only because he was curious, Mordecai came to my office at noon. He'd been in plenty of big firms in his time, but he wanted to see the spot where Mister fell. I gave him a brief tour with a quick narration of the hostage affair. We left in his car. I was thankful for the light Sunday traffic because Mordecai had no interest in what the other cars were doing. "Lante Burton's mother is 38 years old, serving a 10-year sentence for selling crack," he informed me. He'd been on the phone. "Two brothers, both in jail. Lante had a history of prostitution and drugs. No idea of who the father or fathers might be." "Who's your source?" "I found her grandmother in a housing project. The last time she saw Lante, she had only 3 kids, and she was selling drugs with her mother. According to the grandmother, she cut her ties with her daughter and granddaughter because of the drug business."
"Who buries them?"
"Same people who buried Devon Hardy."
"How much would a decent funeral cost?"
"It's negotiable. Are you interested?"
"I'd like to see them taken care of."
We were on Pennsylvania Avenue, moving past the mammoth office buildings of Congress, the Capitol in the background, and I couldn't help but offer a silent curse or two at the fools who wasted billions each month while people were homeless. How could 4 innocent children die in the streets, practically in the shadow of the Capitol, because they had no place to live? "They shouldn't have been born," some people from my side of town would say. The bodies had been taken to the office of the chief medical examiner, which also housed the morgue. It was a 2-story brown aggregate building at D.C. General Hospital. They would be held there until claimed. If no one came forward within 48 hours, they would receive a mandatory embalming, be placed in wooden caskets, and quickly buried in the cemetery near RFK. Mordecai parked in a handicapped space, paused for a second, and said,
"Are you sure you want to go in?"
"I think so." He'd been there before, and he had called ahead. A security guard in an ill-fitting uniform dared to stop us, and Mordecai snapped so loud it scared me. My stomach was in knots anyway. The guard retreated, happy to get away from us. A set of plate glass doors had the word morgue painted in black. Mordecai entered as if he owned the place.
"I'm Mordecai Green, attorney for the Burton family,"
he growled at the young man behind the desk. It was more of a challenge than an announcement. The young man checked a clipboard, then fumbled with some more papers.
"What the hell are you doing?" Mordecai snapped again.
The young man looked up with an attitude, and then realized how large his adversary really was.
"Just a minute," he said, and went to his computer.
Mordecai turned to me and said loudly,
"You'd think they have 1,000 dead bodies in there."
I realized that he had no patience whatsoever with bureaucrats and government workers, and I remembered his story about the apology from the Social Security Secretary. For Mordecai, half of the practice of law was bullying and barking. A pale gentleman with badly dyed black hair and a clammy handshake appeared and introduced himself as Bill. He wore a blue lab jacket and shoes with thick rubber soles. Where do they find people to work in a morgue? We followed him through a door, down a sterile hallway where the temperature began dropping, and finally to the main holding room.
"How many you got today?" Mordecai asked, as if he stopped by all the time to count bodies.
Bill turned the doorknob and said,
12.
"You okay?" Mordecai asked me.
"I don't know." Bill pushed the metal door and we stepped in. The air was frigid, the smell antiseptic. The floor was white tile, the lighting blue fluorescent. I followed Mordecai, my head down, trying not to look around, but it was impossible. The bodies were covered from head to ankle with white sheets, just like you see on television. We passed a set of white feet, a tag around a toe, then some brown ones. We turned and stopped in a corner, a gurney to the left, a table to the right. Bill said,
"Lante Burton,"
and dramatically pulled the sheet down to her waist. It was Ontario's mother, all right, in a plain white gown. Death had left no marks on her face. She could have been sleeping. I couldn't stop staring at her.
"That's her," Mordecai said, as if he'd known her for years.
He looked at me for verification, and I managed a nod. Bill wheeled around, and I held my breath. Only one sheet covered the children. They were lying in a perfect row, tucked closely together, hands folded over their matching gowns. Cherubs, sleeping. Little street soldiers finally at peace. I wanted to touch Ontario, to pat him on the arm and tell him I was sorry. I wanted to wake him up, take him home, feed him, and give him everything he could ever want. I took a step forward for a closer look.
"Don't touch," Bill said.
When I nodded, Mordecai said,
"That's them."
As Bill covered them, I closed my eyes and said a short prayer, one of mercy and forgiveness.
"Don't let it happen again," the Lord said to me.
In a room down the hall, Bill pulled out two large wire baskets containing the personal effects of the family. He dumped them on a table, and we helped him inventory the contents. The clothing they wore was dirty and threadbare. My denim jacket was the nicest item they owned. There were three blankets, a purse, some cheap toys, baby formula, a towel, more dirty clothes, a box of vanilla wafers, an unopened can of beer, some cigarettes, two condoms, and about $20 in bills and change.
"The car is at the city lot," Bill said. "They say it's full of junk."
"We'll take care of it," Mordecai said.
We signed the inventory sheets and left with the personal assets of the Lante Burton family.
"What do we do with this stuff?" I asked.
"Take it to the grandmother. Do you want your coat back?"
"No."
The funeral parlor was owned by a minister Mordecai knew. He didn't like him because the Reverend's church was not friendly enough to the homeless, but he could deal with him. We parked in front of the church on Georgia Avenue near Howard University, a cleaner part of town without as many boards over windows.
"It's best if you stay here," he said. "I can talk to him a lot plainer if we're alone."
I didn't want to sit in the car by myself, but by then I trusted him with my life anyway.
"Sure,"
I said, sinking a few inches and glancing around.
"You'll be all right."
He left, and I locked the doors.
After a few minutes, I relaxed and began to think. Mordecai wanted to be alone with the minister for business reasons. My presence would have complicated matters. Who was I, and what was my interest in the family? The price would rise immediately. The sidewalk was busy. I watched the people scurry by, the wind cutting them sharply. A mother with two children passed me, bundled in nice clothing, all holding hands. Where were they last night when Ontario and family were huddled in the frigid car, breathing the odorless carbon monoxide until they floated away? Where were the rest of us? The world was shutting down. Nothing made sense. In less than a week, I had seen 6 dead street people, and I was ill-equipped to handle the shock. I was an educated white lawyer, well-fed and affluent, on the fast track to serious wealth and all the wonderful things it would buy. Sure, the marriage was over, but I would bounce back. There were plenty of fine women out there. I had no serious worries. I cursed Mister for derailing my life. I cursed Mordecai for making me feel guilty, and Ontario for breaking my heart. A knock on the window jolted me. My nerves were shot to hell anyway. It was Mordecai, standing in the snow next to the curb. I cracked the window. He says he'll do it for 2,000 bucks, all 5. Whatever, I said, and he disappeared. Moments later, he was back, behind the wheel and speeding away. The funeral will be Tuesday here at the church. Wooden caskets, but nice ones. He'll get some flowers, you know, make it look nice. He wanted 3,000, but I convinced him that there would be some press, so he might get himself on television. He liked that. 2,000 isn't bad. Thanks, Mordecai. Are you okay? No. We said little as we drove back to my office. Claire's younger brother, James, had been diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease, thus the family summit in Providence. It had nothing to do with me. I listened to her talk about the weekend, the shock of the news, the tears and prayers, as they leaned on each other and comforted James and his wife. Hers is a family of huggers and criers, and I was thrilled she had not called me to come up. The treatment would start immediately. The prognosis was good. She was happy to be home and relieved to have someone to unload on. We sipped wine in the den by the fire, a quilt over our feet. It was almost romantic, though I was too scarred to even think of being sentimental. I made a valiant effort at hearing her words, grieving appropriately for poor James, interjecting fitting little phrases. This was not what I had expected, and I wasn't sure if it was what I wanted. I thought we might shadow box, perhaps even skirmish. Soon it had to get ugly, then hopefully turn civil, as we handled our separation like real adults. But after Ontario, I was not prepared to deal with any issue involving emotion. I was drained. She kept telling me how tired I looked. I almost thanked her. I listened hard until she finished. Then the conversation slowly drifted to me and my weekend. I told her everything. My new life as a volunteer in the shelters. Then Ontario and his family. I showed her the story in the paper. She was genuinely moved, but also puzzled. I was not the same person I'd been a week earlier, and she was not sure she liked the latest version any better than the old. I was not sure either. Chapter 11. As young workaholics, Claire and I did not need alarm clocks, especially for Monday mornings, when we faced an entire week of challenges. We were up at 5, eating cereal at 5:30, then off in separate directions, practically racing to see who could leave first. Because of the wine, I had managed to sleep without being haunted by the nightmare of the weekend. And as I drove to the office, I was determined to place some distance between myself and the street people. I would endure the funeral. I would somehow find the time to do pro bono work for the homeless. I would pursue my friendship with Mordecai, probably even become a regular in his office. I would drop in occasionally on Miss Dolly and help her feed the hungry. I would give money and help raise more of it for the poor. Certainly, I could be more valuable as a source of funds than as another poverty lawyer. Driving in the dark to the office, I decided that I needed a string of 18-hour days to readjust my priorities. My career had suffered a minor derailment. An orgy of work would straighten things out. Only a fool would jump from the gravy train I was riding. I chose a different elevator from Mister's. He was history. I shut him out of my mind. I did not look at the conference room where he died. I threw my briefcase and coat on a chair in my office and went for coffee. Bouncing down the hallway before 6 in the morning, speaking to a colleague here, a clerk there, removing my jacket, rolling up my sleeves, it was great to be back. I scanned the Wall Street Journal first, partly because I knew it would have nothing to do with dying street people in D.C. Then, the Post. On the front page of the Metro section, there was a small story about Lante Burton's family, with a photo of her grandmother weeping outside an apartment building. I read it, then put it aside. I knew more than the reporter, and I was determined not to be distracted. Under the Post was a plain, manila, legal-sized file, the kind our firm used by the millions. It was unmarked, and that made it suspicious. It was just lying there, exposed, on the center of my desk, placed there by some anonymous person. I opened it slowly. There were only 2 sheets of paper inside. The first was a copy of yesterday's story in the Post, the same one I'd read 10 times and shown to Claire last night. Under it was a copy of something lifted from an official Drake and Sweeney file. The heading read, Evictees, River Oaks /TAG Incorporated. The left-hand column contained the numbers 1 through 17. Number 4 was Devon Hardy. Number 15 read, Lante Burton and 3 or 4 children. I slowly laid the file on the desk, stood and walked to the door, locked it, then leaned on it. The first couple of minutes passed in absolute silence. I stared at the file in the center of the desk. I had to assume it was true and accurate. Why would anyone fabricate such a thing? Then I picked it up again, carefully. Under the second sheet of paper, on the inside of the file itself, my anonymous informant had scribbled with a pencil, "The eviction was legally and ethically wrong." It was printed in block letters in an effort to avoid detection should I have it analyzed. The markings were faint, the lead hardly touching the file. I kept the door locked for an hour, during which time I took turns standing at the window watching the sunrise and sitting at my desk staring at the file. The traffic increased in the hallway, and then I heard Polly's voice. I unlocked the door, greeted her as if everything was swell, and proceeded to go through the motions. The morning was packed with meetings and conferences, 2 of them with Rudolph and clients. I performed adequately, though I couldn't remember anything we said or did. Rudolph was so proud to have his star back at full throttle. I was almost rude to those who wanted to chat about the hostage crisis and its aftershocks. I appeared to be the same, and I was my usual hard-charging self, so the concerns about my stability vanished. Late in the morning, my father called. I could not remember the last time he'd called me at the office. He said it was raining in Memphis. He was sitting around the house, bored, and, well, he and my mother were worried about me. Claire was fine, I explained. Then, to find safe ground, I told him about her brother James, a person he had met once at the wedding. I sounded properly concerned about Claire's family, and that pleased him. Dad was just happy to reach me at the office. I was still there, making the big money, going after more. He asked me to keep in touch. 30 minutes later, my brother Warner called from his office, high above downtown Atlanta. He was 6 years older, a partner in another mega firm, a no-holds-barred litigator. Because of the age difference, Warner and I had never been close as kids, but we enjoyed each other's company. During his divorce, 3 years earlier, he had confided in me weekly. He was on the clock, same as I, so I knew the conversation would be brief. "Talk to Dad," he said. He told me everything. I'm sure he did. I understand how you feel. We all go through it. You work hard, make the big money, never stop to help the little people. Then something happens, and you think back to law school, back to the first year when we were full of ideals and wanted to use our law degrees to save humanity. Remember that?
Yes, a long time ago.
Right. During my first year of law school, they took a survey. Over half my class wanted to do public interest law. When we graduated, 3 years later, everybody went for the money. I don't know what happened.
Law school makes you greedy.
I suppose. Our firm has a program where you can take a year off, sort of a sabbatical, and do public interest law. After 12 months, you return as if you never left. You guys do anything like that?
Vintage Warner. I had a problem. He already had the solution. Nice and neat. 12 months, I'm a new man. A quick detour, but my future is secured.
Not for associates, I said. I've heard of a partner or two leaving to work for this administration or that one, then returning after a couple of years, but never an associate.
But your circumstances are different. You've been traumatized, damn near killed, simply because you were a member of the firm.
I'd throw my weight around some, tell him you need time off. Take a year, then get your ass back to the office.
It might work, I said, trying to placate him.
He was a type A personality, pushy as hell, always one word away from an argument, especially with the family.
I gotta run, I said.
So did he. We promised to talk more later. Lunch was with Rudolph and a client at a splendid restaurant. It was called a working lunch, which meant we abstained from alcohol, which also meant we would bill the client for the time. Rudolph went for $400 an hour, me for $300. We worked and ate for 2 hours, so the lunch cost the client $1,400. Our firm had an account with the restaurant, so it would be billed to Drake and Sweeney, and somewhere along the way our bean counters in the basement would find a way to bill the client for the cost of the food as well. The afternoon was nonstop calls and conferences. Through sheer willpower, I kept my game face and got through it, billing heavily as I went. Antitrust law had never seemed so hopelessly dense and boring. It was almost 5 before I found a few minutes alone. I said goodbye to Polly and locked the door again. I opened the mysterious file and began making random notes on a legal pad, scribblings and flowcharts with arrows striking River Oaks and Drake and Sweeney from all directions. Braden Chance, the real estate partner I'd confronted about the file, took most of the shots for the firm. My principal suspect was his paralegal, the young man who had heard our sharp words and who seconds later had referred to Chance as an ass as I was leaving their suite. He would know the details of the eviction, and he would have access to the file. With a pocket phone, to avoid any DNS records, I called a paralegal in antitrust. His office was around the corner from mine. He referred me to another, and with little effort I learned that the guy I wanted was Hector Palma. He'd been with the firm about 3 years, all in real estate. I planned to track him down, but outside the office. Mordecai called, inquired about my dinner plans for the evening.
I'll treat, he said.
Soup?
He laughed. Of course not. I know an excellent place. We agreed to meet at 7.
Claire was back in her surgeon's mode, oblivious to time, meals, or husband. She had checked in mid-afternoon, just a quick word on the run. Had no idea when she might be home, but very late. For dinner, every man for himself. I didn't hold it against her. She had learned the fast-track lifestyle from me. We met at a restaurant near DuPont Circle. The bar at the front was packed with well-paid government types, having a drink before fleeing the city. We had a drink in the back in a tight booth.
The Burton story is big and getting bigger, he said, sipping a draft beer.
I'm sorry, I've been in a cave for the past 12 hours. What's happened?
Lots of press. 4 dead kids and their mama living in a car. They find them a mile from Capitol Hill, where they're in the process of reforming welfare to send more mothers into the streets. It's beautiful.
So the funeral should be quite a show.
No doubt. I've talked to a dozen homeless activists today. They'll be there, and they're planning to bring their people with them. The place will be packed with street people. Again, lots of press.
Four little coffins next to their mothers. Cameras catching it all for the 6 o'clock news. We're having a rally before and a march afterward. Maybe something good will come from their deaths. Maybe.
As a seasoned big city lawyer, I knew there was a purpose behind every lunch and dinner invitation. Mordecai had something on his mind. I could tell by the way his eyes followed mine.
Any idea why they were homeless? I asked, fishing.
No, probably the usual. I haven't had time to ask questions.
Driving over, I had decided that I could not tell him about the mysterious file and its contents. It was confidential, known to me only because of my position at Drake and Sweeney. To reveal what I had learned about the activities of a client would be an egregious breach of professional responsibility. The thought of divulging it scared me. Plus, I had not verified anything. The waiter brought salads, and we began eating.
"We had a firm meeting this afternoon," Mordecai said between bites. "Me, Abraham, Sophia. We need some help."
I was not surprised to hear that.
"What kind of help?"
"Another lawyer."
"I thought you were broke."
"We keep a little reserve. Plus, we've adopted a new marketing strategy."
The idea of the 14th Street Legal Clinic worried about a marketing strategy was humorous, and that was what he intended. We both smiled.
"If we could get the new lawyer to spend 10 hours a week raising money, then he could afford himself."
Another series of smiles.
He continued,
"As much as we hate to admit it, our survival will depend on our ability to raise money. The Cohen Trust is declining. We've had the luxury of not begging, but now it's got to change."
"What's the rest of the job?"
"Street law. You've had a good dose of it. You've seen our place. It's a dump. Sophia's a shrew. Abraham's an ass. The clients smell bad, and the money is a joke."
"How much money?"
"We can offer you $30,000 a year, but we can only promise you half of it for the first 6 months."
"Why?"
"The trust closes its books June 30th, at which time they'll tell us how much we get for the next fiscal year, beginning July 1st. We have enough in reserve to pay you for the next 6 months. After that, the four of us will split what's left after expenses."
Abraham and Sophia agreed to this.
"Yep," after a little speech by me. "We figure you have good contacts within the established bar, and since you're well-educated, nice-looking, bright, and all that crap, you should be a natural at raising money."
"What if I don't want to raise money?"
"Then the four of us could lower our salaries even more, perhaps go to $20,000 a year, then to $15,000, and when the trust dries up, we could hit the streets just like our clients, homeless lawyers."
"So I'm the future of the 14th Street Legal Clinic."
"That's what we decided. We'll take you in as a full partner. Let's see Drake and Sweeney top that."
"I'm touched," I said. I was also a bit frightened. The job offer was not unexpected, but its arrival opened a door I was hesitant to walk through. Black bean soup arrived, and we ordered more beer.
"What's Abraham's story?" I asked.
"Jewish kid from Brooklyn, middle class, came to Washington to work on Senator Moynihan's staff. Spent a few years on the Hill, landed on the street. Extremely bright. He spends most of his time coordinating litigation with pro bono lawyers from big firms. Right now he's suing the Census Bureau to be certain the homeless get counted. And he's suing the D.C. school system to make sure homeless kids get an education. His people skills leave a lot to be desired, but he's great in the backroom plotting litigation."
"And Sophia?"
"A career social worker who's been taking night classes in law school for 11 years. She acts and thinks like a lawyer, especially when she's abusing government workers. You'll hear her say, 'This is Sophia Mendoza, attorney at law,' 10 times a day."
"She's also the secretary?"
"Nope, we don't have secretaries. You do your own typing, filing, coffee making."
He leaned forward a few inches and lowered his voice.
"The three of us have been together for a long time, Michael, and we've carved out little niches. To be honest, we need a fresh face with some new ideas."
"The money is certainly appealing," I said, a weak effort at humor. He grinned anyway.
"You don't do it for the money. You do it for your soul."
My soul kept me awake most of the night. Did I have the guts to walk away?
Was I seriously considering taking a job which paid so little? I was literally saying goodbye to millions. The things and possessions I longed for would become fading memories. The timing wasn't bad. With the marriage over, it somehow seemed fitting that I make drastic changes on all fronts. Chapter 12. I called in sick Tuesday. Probably the flu, I told Polly, who, as she was trained to do, wanted specifics. Fever, sore throat, headaches. All of the above. Any and all. I didn't care. One had better be completely sick to miss work at the firm. She would do a form and send it to Rudolph. Anticipating his call, I left the apartment and wandered around Georgetown during the early morning. The snow was melting fast. The high would be in the 50s. I killed an hour loitering along Washington Harbor, sampling cappuccino from a number of vendors, watching the rowers freeze on the Potomac. At 10, I left for the funeral. The sidewalk in front of the church was barricaded. Cops were standing around, their motorcycles parked on the street. Farther down were the television vans. A large crowd, listening to a speaker yell into a microphone as I drove by. There were a few hastily painted placards held above heads for the benefit of the cameras. I parked on a side street 3 blocks away and hurried toward the church. I avoided the front by heading for a side door, which was being guarded by an elderly usher. I asked if there was a balcony. He asked if I was a reporter. He took me inside and pointed to a door. I thanked him and went through it, then up a flight of shaky stairs, until I emerged on the balcony overlooking a beautiful sanctuary below. The carpet was burgundy, the pews dark wood, the windows stained and clean. It was a very handsome church, and for a second I could understand why the Reverend was reluctant to open it to the homeless. I was alone with my choice of seating. I walked quietly to a spot above the rear door with a direct view down the center aisle to the pulpit. A choir began singing outside on the front steps, and I sat in the tranquility of the empty church, the music drifting in. The music stopped. The doors opened, the stampede began. The balcony floor shook as the mourners poured into the sanctuary. The choir took its place behind the pulpit. The Reverend directed traffic, the TV crews in one corner, the small family in the front pew, the activists and their homeless down the center section. Mordecai ambled in with 2 people I didn't know. A door to one side opened, and the prisoners marched out. Lante's mother and 2 brothers, clad in blue prison garb, cuffed at the wrists and ankles, chained together and escorted by 4 armed guards. They were placed in the 2nd pew, center aisle, behind the grandmother and some other relatives. When things were still, the organ began, low and sad. There was a racket under me, and all heads turned around. The Reverend assumed the pulpit and instructed us to stand. Ushers with white gloves rolled the wooden coffins down the aisle and lined them end to end across the front of the church, with Lante's in the center. The baby's was tiny, less than 3 feet long. Ontario's, Alonzo's, and Dante's were mid-sized. It was an appalling sight, and the wailing began. The choir started to hum and sway. The ushers arranged flowers around the caskets, and I thought for 1 horrifying second they were going to open them. I had never been to a black funeral before. I had no idea what to expect, but I had seen news clips from other infamous funerals in which the casket was sometimes opened, the family kissing the corpse. The vultures with the cameras were ever ready. But the caskets remained closed, and so the world didn't learn what I knew, that Ontario and family looked very much at peace. We sat down, and the Reverend served up a lengthy prayer, then a solo from Sister Somebody, then moments of silence. The Reverend read scripture and preached for a bit. He was followed by a homeless activist who delivered a scathing attack on a society and its leaders who allowed such a thing to happen. She blamed Congress, especially the Republicans, and she blamed the city for its lack of leadership and the courts and the bureaucracy. But she saved her harshest diatribe for the upper classes, those with money and power who didn't care for the poor and the sick. She was articulate and angry, very effective, I thought, but not exactly at home at a funeral. They clapped for her when she finished. The Reverend then spent a very long time blasting everyone who wasn't of color and had money. A solo, some more scripture, then the choir launched into a soulful hymn that made me want to cry. A procession formed to lay hands upon the dead, but it quickly broke down as the mourners began wailing and rubbing the caskets. "Open them up!" someone screamed, but the Reverend shook his head no. They bunched toward the pulpit, crowding around the caskets, yelling and sobbing as the choir cranked it up several notches. The grandmother was the loudest, and she was stroked and soothed by the others. Where were these people during the last months of Lante's life? Those little bodies lying up there in boxes had never known so much love. The cameras inched closer as more and more mourners broke down. It was more of a show than anything else. The Reverend finally stepped in and restored order. He prayed again with organ music in the background. When he finished, a long dismissal began as the people paraded by the caskets one last time. The service lasted an hour and a half. For $2,000, it wasn't a bad production. I was proud I'd paid for it, if for no other reason than to bury my little buddies with some dignity. They rallied again outside and began a march in the general direction of Capitol Hill. Mordecai was in the middle of it, and as they disappeared around a corner, I wondered how many marches and demonstrations he had been in. "Not enough," he would probably answer. Rudolf Mays had become a partner at Drake & Sweeney at the age of 30, still a record. And if life continued as he planned, he would one day be the oldest working partner. The law was his life, as his three former wives could attest. Everything else he touched was disastrous, but Rudolf was the consummate, big-firm team player. He was waiting for me at 6 p.m. in his office behind a pile of work. Polly and the secretaries were gone, as were most of the paralegals and clerks. The hall traffic slowed considerably after 5:30. I closed the door, sat down. "Thought you were sick," he said. "I'm leaving, Rudolf," I said boldly, but my stomach was in knots. He shoved books out of the way and put the cap on his expensive pen. "I'm listening." "I'm leaving the firm. I have an offer to work for a public interest firm." "Don't be stupid, Michael." "I'm not being stupid. I've made up my mind, and I went out of here with as little trouble as possible." "You'll be a partner in 3 years." "I've found a better deal than that." He couldn't think of a response, so he rolled his eyes in frustration. "Come on, Mike. You can't crack up over one incident." "I'm not cracking up, Rudolf. I'm simply moving into another field." "None of the other 8 hostages are doing this." "Good for them. If they're happy, then I'm happy for them. Besides, they're in litigation, a strange breed." "Where are you going?"
"A legal clinic near Logan Circle. It specializes in homeless law."
"Homeless law?"
"Yep."
"How much are they paying you?"
"A bloody fortune. Want to make a donation to the clinic?"
"You're losing your mind."
"Just a little crisis, Rudolf. I'm only 32, too young for the midlife crazies. I figure I'll get mine over with early."
"Take a month off. Go work with the homeless, get it out of your system, then come back. This is a terrible time to leave, Mike. You know how far behind we are."
"Won't work, Rudolf. It's no fun if there's a safety net."
"Fun? You're doing this for fun?"
"Absolutely. Think how much fun it would be to work without looking at a time clock."
"What about Claire?" he asked, revealing the depths of his desperation. He hardly knew her, and he was the least qualified person in the firm to dispense marital advice.
"She's okay," I said.
I'd like to leave Friday. He grunted in defeat. He closed his eyes, slowly shook his head. I don't believe this. I'm sorry, Rudolph. We shook hands and promised to meet for an early breakfast to discuss my unfinished work. I didn't want Polly to hear it secondhand, so I went to my office and called her. She was at home in Arlington, cooking dinner. It ruined her week. I picked up Thai food and took it home. I chilled some wine, fixed the table, and began rehearsing my lines. If Claire suspected an ambush, it wasn't evident. Over the years, we had developed the habit of simply ignoring each other as opposed to fighting. Therefore, our tactics were unrefined. But I liked the idea of a blind side, of being thoroughly prepared with the shock, then ready with the quips. I thought it would be nice and unfair, completely acceptable within the confines of a crumbling marriage. It was almost 10, she had eaten on the run hours earlier, so we went straight to the den with glasses of wine. I stoked the fire, and we settled into our favorite chairs. After a few minutes, I said, "We need to talk." "What is it?" she asked, completely unworried. "I'm thinking of leaving Drake and Sweeney."
"Oh, really?"
She took a drink. I admired her coolness. She either expected this or wanted to seem unconcerned. "Yes, I can't go back there."
"Why not?"
"I'm ready for a change. The corporate work is suddenly boring and unimportant, and I want to do something to help people."
"That's nice."
She was already thinking about the money, and I was anxious to see how long it would take to get around to it.
"In fact, that's very admirable, Michael.
I told you about Mordecai Green. His clinic has offered me a job. I'm starting Monday."
"Monday?"
"Yes."
"So you've made your decision already?"
"Yes."
"Without any discussion with me. I have no say in the matter, is that right?"
"I can't go back to the firm, Claire. I told Rudolph today." Another sip, a slight grinding of the teeth, a flash of anger, but she let it pass. Her self-control was amazing. We watched the fire, hypnotized by the orange flames. She spoke next.
"Can I ask what this does for us financially?"
"It changes things."
"How much is the new salary?"
$30,000 a year.
$30,000 a year,
she repeated. Then she said it again, somehow making it sound even lower.
"That's less than what I make."
Her salary was $31,000, a figure that would increase dramatically in the years to come. Serious money was not far away. For purposes of the discussion, I plan to have no sympathy for any whining about money. "You don't do public interest law for the money," I said, trying not to sound pious. "As I recall, you didn't go to med school for the money." Like every med student in the country, she had begun her studies vowing that money was not the attraction. She wanted to help humanity. Same for law students. We all lied. She watched the fire and did the math. I guessed she was probably thinking about the rent. It was a very nice apartment. At $2,400 a month, it should have been even nicer. The furnishings were adequate. We were proud of where we lived. Right address, beautiful row house, swanky neighborhood. But we spent so little time there, and we seldom entertained. Moving would be an adjustment, but we could endure it. We had always been open about our finances. Nothing was hidden. She knew we had around $51,000 in mutual funds and $12,000 in the checking account. I was amazed at how little we'd saved in 6 years of marriage. When you're on the fast track at a big firm, the money seems endless.
"I guess we'll have to make adjustments, won't we?"
she said, staring coldly at me. The word adjustments was dripping with connotations.
"I suppose so." "I'm tired," she said. She drained the glass and went to the bedroom. How pathetic, I thought. We couldn't even muster enough rancor to have a decent fight. Of course, I fully realized my new status in life. I was a wonderful story. Ambitious young lawyer, transformed into an advocate for the poor, turns back on blue-chip firm to work for nothing. Even though she thought I was losing my mind, Claire had found it hard to criticize a saint.
I put a log on the fire, fixed another drink, and slept on the sofa. Chapter 13. The partners had a private dining room on the 8th floor, and it was supposed to be an honor for an associate to eat there. Rudolph was the sort of klutz who would think that a bowl of Irish oatmeal at 7 a.m. in their special room would help return me to my senses. How could I turn my back on a future filled with power breakfasts? He had exciting news. He'd spoken with Arthur late the night before, and there was in the works a proposal to grant me a 12-month sabbatical. The firm would supplement whatever salary the clinic paid. It was a worthy cause. They should do more to protect the rights of the poor. I would be treated as the firm's designated pro bono boy for an entire year, and they could all feel good about themselves. I would return with my batteries recharged, my other interests quelled, my talents once again directed to the glory of Drake and Sweeney. I was impressed and touched by the idea, and I could not simply dismiss it. I promised him I would think about it, and quickly. He cautioned that it would have to be approved by the executive committee, since I was not a partner. The firm had never considered such a leave for an associate. Rudolph was desperate for me to stay, and it had little to do with friendship. Our antitrust division was log-jammed with work, and we needed at least two more senior associates with my experience. It was a terrible time for me to leave, but I didn't care. The firm had 800 lawyers. They would find the bodies they needed. The year before, I had billed just under $750,000. That was why I was eating breakfast in their fancy little room and listening to their urgent plans to keep me. It also made sense to take my annual salary, throw it at the homeless or any charity I wished for that matter, then entice me back after 1 year. Once he finished with the idea of the sabbatical, we proceeded to review the most pressing matters in my office. We were listing things to do when Braden Chance sat at a table not far from ours. He didn't see me at first. There were a dozen or so partners eating, most alone, most deep in the morning papers. I tried to ignore him, but I finally looked over and caught him glaring at me. "Good morning, Braden," I said loudly, startling him and causing Rudolph to jerk around to see who it was. Chance nodded, said nothing, and suddenly became involved with some toast. "You know him?" Rudolph asked under his breath. "We've met," I said. During our brief encounter in his office, Chance had demanded the name of my supervising partner. I'd given him Rudolph's name. It was obvious he had not lodged any complaints. "An ass," Rudolph said, barely audible. It was unanimous. He flipped a page, immediately forgot about Chance, and plowed ahead. There was a lot of unfinished work in my office. I found myself thinking of Chance and the eviction file. He had a soft look, with pale skin, delicate features, a fragile manner. I could not imagine him in the streets, examining abandoned warehouses filled with squatters, actually getting his hands dirty to make sure his work was thorough. Of course, he never did that. He had paralegals. Chance sat at his desk and supervised the paperwork, billing several hundred an hour, while the Hector Palmas of the firm took care of the nasty details. Chance had lunch and played golf with the executives of River Oaks. That was his role as a partner. He probably didn't know the names of the people evicted from the River Oaks TAG warehouse, and why should he? They were just squatters, nameless, faceless, homeless. He wasn't there with the cops when they were dragged from their little dwellings and thrown into the streets. But Hector Palma probably saw it happen. And if Chance didn't know the names of Lante Burton and family, then he couldn't make the connection between the eviction and their deaths. Or maybe he did know now. Maybe someone had told him. These questions would have to be answered by Hector Palma and soon. It was Wednesday. I was leaving on Friday. Rudolph wrapped up our breakfast at 8, just in time for another meeting in his office with some very important people. I went to my desk and read the post. There was a gut-wrenching photo of the 5 unopened caskets in the sanctuary, and a thorough review of the service and the march afterward. There was also an editorial, a well-written challenge to all of us with food and roofs to stop and think about the Lante Burtons of our city. They were not going away.
They could not be swept from the streets and deposited in some hidden place so we didn't have to see them. They were living in cars, squatting in shacks, freezing in makeshift tents, sleeping on park benches, waiting for beds in crowded and sometimes dangerous shelters. We shared the same city. They were a part of our society. If we didn't help them, they would multiply in numbers, and they would continue to die in our streets. I cut the editorial from the paper, folded it, and placed it in my wallet. Through the paralegal network, I made contact with Hector Palma. It would not be wise to approach him directly. Chance was probably lurking nearby. We met in the main library on the third floor, between stacks of books, away from security cameras and anybody else. He was extremely nervous. "Did you put that file on my desk?" I asked him point blank. There was little time for games. "What file?" he asked, cutting his eyes around as if gunmen were tracking us. "The River Oaks TAG eviction. You handled it, right?" He didn't know how much I knew or how little. "Yeah," he said. "Where's the file?" He pulled a book off the shelf and acted as though he were deep in research. "Chance keeps all the files." "In his office?" "Yes, locked in a file cabinet." We were practically whispering. I had not been nervous about the meeting, but I caught myself glancing around. Anybody watching would have immediately known that we were up to something. "What's in the file?" I asked.
"Bad stuff."
"Tell me."
"I have a wife and 4 kids. I'm not about to get fired."
"You have my word."
"You're leaving. What do you care?"
Word traveled fast, but I was not surprised. I often wondered who gossiped more, the lawyers or their secretaries. Probably the paralegals. "Why did you put that file on my desk?" I asked. He reached for another book, his right hand literally shaking.
"I don't know what you're talking about."
He flipped a few pages, then walked to the end of the row. I followed along, certain no one was anywhere near us. He stopped and found another book. He still wanted to talk. "I need that file," I said.
"I don't have it."
"Then how can I get it?"
"You'll have to steal it."
"Fine. Where do I get a key?" He studied my face for a moment, trying to decide how serious I was.
"I don't have a key," he said.
"How'd you get the list of evictees?"
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"Yes, you do. You put it on my desk."
"You're as crazy as hell," he said,
and walked away. I waited for him to stop, but he kept going, past the rows of shelves, past the stacked tiers, past the front desk, and out of the library. I had no intention of busting my ass my last 3 days at the firm, regardless of what I'd led Rudolph to believe. Instead, I covered my desk with antitrust litter, shut the door, stared at the walls, and smiled at all the things I was leaving behind. The pressure was lifting with every breath. No more labor with a time clock wrapped around my throat. No more 80-hour weeks because my ambitious colleagues might be doing 85. No more brown-nosing those above me. No more nightmares about getting the partnership door slammed in my face. I called Mordecai and formally accepted the job. He laughed and joked about finding a way to pay me. I would start Monday, but he wanted me to stop by earlier for a brief orientation. I pictured the interior of the 14th Street Legal Clinic and wondered which of the empty, cluttered offices I would be assigned, as if it mattered. By late afternoon, I was spending most of my time accepting grave farewells from friends and colleagues convinced I had truly lost my mind. I took it well. After all, I was approaching sainthood. Meanwhile, my wife was visiting a divorce lawyer, a female one with a reputation of being a merciless ball squeezer.
This book is continued on Disc 4.